This is case number 58935, Charles P. Nelson v. State of Nevada. Chris Arm here representing the appellant. Mr. Arm, you may proceed on behalf of the appellant.
Well, if I can reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
May I please the court? Mr. Nelson is entitled to a new trial in this case for multiple reasons. I'll get right to the issues. The first issue that was very apparent in this case is that one of the most important witnesses in the case, a man named Alonzo Woods, he was present in the residence. He was brought into the residence by the perpetrators, and he was a witness to not the exact killing. He believed the killing had happened. He drove out of the window. He immediately, within a day, identified the co-defendant, John Scott, from the six-pack lineup. Unfortunately, he looked at three separate lineups of Mr. Nelson, according to the state's brief. They calculated three times. They showed Mr. Nelson in a six-pack lineup. Not any of those times could Mr. Woods identify Mr. Nelson. Then police decided that that would not be sufficient enough, that they'd give him a fourth chance. So they set up sort of an unusual procedure at the Clark County Detention Center where Mr. Woods actually walked by Mr. Nelson to see if he would recognize him. He did not recognize him. So at that point, we have four attempts to identify Mr. Nelson. None of them have succeeded. The state also concedes that the co-defendant's attorney went to the prison and showed Mr. Woods pictures or a picture of Mr. Nelson. And then, right before trial, almost 3 years later, Mr. Tomchak, the other prosecutor on the case, apparently showed a six-pack or some pictures of suspects, and this time, Mr. Woods said, I'll identify him. I'll say it's him. However, when it comes to trial, I file a pretrial motion saying, I don't think you should even let this man, having been given four attempts by law enforcement to identify Mr. Nelson, I don't think you should be allowed to let this man come into court, look over at the defendant, and say, there's the man that did this. But the judge then asked, Judge Herndon asked Mr. Tomchak, is this man going to identify Mr. Nelson? Mr. Tomchak says, I have no idea. I don't know if he's going to identify him. When Mr. Woods gets on the stand then and identifies Mr. Nelson, because my motion was denied, what does Mr. Woods say under cross-examination? I told the prosecutor I was going to identify him. So to me, under the Foster case, the U.S. Supreme Court has laid out that we look at the totality of the circumstances whether an identification is unnecessarily suggestive. And it's interesting because in Foster, the police showed a lineup to the victim, could not identify him, showed a second lineup. This time there was a tentative identification, and then there was a third attempt where there was a positive identification. Here we have four when nothing occurs. When the co-defendant's attorney going to the prison showed Mr. Woods identification, then the prosecutor doing it, and finally we have identification. That is unnecessarily suggestive under the totality of the circumstances. I think that that should mandate reversal. Another issue I'd like to address with the court is the second most important witness in the case was a lady named Jacqueline Frenchwood. Ms. Frenchwood, having lingered around for 8 months, is approached by law enforcement, told that she could be charged as an accessory, and then decides to tell law enforcement that, yes, Charles Nelson and LaShawna Hayward were in a vehicle and that some event occurred. The state presented Ms. Frenchwood, that was essentially a star witness, as a school teacher who fell on hard times from 10 years ago. She's a school teacher, fell on hard times. I felt prior to that I should be allowed to impeach Ms. Frenchwood with the fact that she had used 25 previous names, 25. 7 dates of birth, 6 social security numbers. I was getting that for a pre-sentence report. The district court denied my request to use that as impeachment. At that point, I followed the court's order, and I continue to follow the court's order. But when the state then stands up and says, oh, Ms. Frenchwood's fallen on hard times, she was a school teacher, then that surely opened the door for impeachment. And
Mr. Allen, didn't you use some other impeachment, though, as to Ms. Frenchwood?
I was able to use the 2 felony convictions, but no facts from the felony. I was able to say, isn't it true you were twice convicted of felony convictions? And that's the extent of it. And that also comes out later in the brief, where I thought was misconduct was not Ms. Christensen, but the other prosecutor then told the jury in the closing argument that Ms. Frenchwood had, all she had ever done was go into a store and try to attempt to steal something. Those are facts, not in evidence. And again, it somehow made Ms. Ms. French would look very good in a very good light. Here's a school teacher who just fell on some hard times. Would it have made a difference if I were able to tell the jury this woman had been lying to law enforcement for all these years? When she says she's a school teacher, what proof is there she's a school teacher? And so I think that a good analysis is done by several courts in Michigan and one in Massachusetts, which I cite in my reply brief, would say that you should be able to use aliases as a form of impeachment. And here, I think that's exactly what I wanted to do. And if it wasn't available to me in the first place, which I think it should be under the analysis given by the Michigan court and Michigan courts and Massachusetts, once the state presented her in the light of this sort of teacher who'd fallen on hard times, then I most certainly believe that I should have been allowed to use that as impeachment. The next issue I'd like to address is a letter that the co-defendant sent. The co-defendant and Mr. Nelson went to trial. We were sitting there, and then the state decided to use a letter that we were aware of that the co-defendant had sent. And in the letter, the co-defendant, she makes some statements that are clearly implicating Mr. Nelson. And you'll have to excuse my language. The portion of the letter that is damaging is very offensive. She says, Jackie places me at the scene. Yes, I did go pick up my shit. He needed me to go handle some business for him on my day. That shit was bad, and he did not want to face the nigga that he had to fuck with. That language implicates Mr. Nelson. And as I see the state's response, what's interesting about the state's response is they say, well, when he says he, they sort of have two responses to that. One, that maybe she was referring to Mr. Scott. So maybe this language is language that says, okay, I'm guilty, but it's the co-defendant that may be guilty, because who is he? Maybe it's Mr. Nelson, maybe it's Mr. Scott. When I come back on the reply on and say, okay, wait a second, so you're saying that there's a 50-50 chance they think it's Scott, and they think it's a 50-50 chance it's Mr. Nelson. Well, isn't that a problem in and of itself? And Mr. Nelson is the one sitting there at trial. Then they also argue, well, who is he? We don't have to sanitize it. And what I noted is in their brief, they didn't address Duckworth and Martin. In Duckworth and Martin, this court previously stated you cannot sanitize a statement where any reasonably intelligent juror is going to understand. I know who they're talking about. You can take out the word Justice Gibbons, but when you're standing there, I know who they're talking about. They're talking about the man sitting at counsel table. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it seemed like a direct violation of Duckworth Martin. And as I read that statement to you, I always thought, why couldn't they have just sanitized it to the point where they left out the last line and just left it, Jackie places me at the scene. Yes, I did go pick up my, she says that word, he needed me to go handle some business for him on my day. If they just left that in there, they would have been able to convict LaShawna Hayward with it and then sanitize it to the point where she doesn't implicate anybody else. I think it's a violation of Bruton, I think it's a violation of Duxford and Martin. I also see that another issue I'd like to address with the court is the fact that the state was able to bring out a gun that was located in my client's car, or it was actually the co-defendant's car when my client was present, almost 2 months after the crime. The state had actually thought that a BB gun found near the victim's vehicle was the weapon used as a ruse because nobody was shot in the residence. And so I'll sort of join this with two arguments. One, that they said, well, that's an important fact. Even though there's no proof that that gun had anything to do with this case whatsoever. Then I try to show that this other lady, Joyce Fleming, was telling people she's a security guard at the Hard Rock. Police came upon her because her cell phone was used 4 times within an hour and a half of the murder to contact the victim. Police talked to her, she said, I didn't even know the guy. People use my cell phone. Well, apparently she was so distraught, she was informing the director and assistant director of the Hard Rock Security that she was distraught over the death. She believed her son was guilty of the crime, and she had attended the funeral. I had outside the court those people waiting to come in and testify. According to my brief, and I cite to the record where Mr. Tomchak had made an agreement with me that we would be able to use that murder. He got up, showed the lead detective a scope, and said, look, doesn't meet height and weight. Mr. Fleming doesn't meet the height and weight of the supposed perpetrators. Then when I started to call witnesses, he objected. He said, you can't bring in the murder. The court agreed. He said, I couldn't bring in the murder. So why I think that all comes together money is, why should I be precluded then from letting that information out, having made an agreement that is on the record with the state and uncontradicted by the state? And two, why can they bring out a gun that is completely unrelated to the incident and say, well, it shows that Mr. Nelson could have had access to a gun 2 months later, but I can't bring out that Mr. Fleming had possibly been a suspect and 2 weeks later, after this crime, had murdered another drug dealer. The man had opened the door and he had shot him. I know there are other issues, but I have run out of time.
But we'll write them all so we can talk about what you feel the most important ones, and counsel can do likewise. Thank you, Mr. Arnn. We have about 4.5 minutes left for rebuttal. Mr. Christensen, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'd like to address each one of the claims that were brought up. I don't have time, but I want to make it clear. We dispute appellant's version of the facts on each and every one of them. And if you review the full record in this case, it becomes clear that he's presented his case based on mischaracterizations, inaccuracies, and plucking small pieces out and arguing them out of context so they no longer resemble what they stood for at trial. And some of those he just touched on, and I'd like to briefly touch on some of those.
One I'm concerned about, I know you've got a lot of issues, and I'll voice that, and maybe my colleagues have some specific concerns, on the Frenchwood testimony, under NRS 50.085 subsection 3, what it seems to me what Mr. Arnn argued about, Ms. Frenchwood's alleged dishonesty would be subject to cross-examination. You can't prove, we couldn't prove that extrinsic evidence, but you could ask about that. If we conclude that was error, first of all, do you think that was error? And secondly, if we conclude it's error, is it harmless? I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, the first analysis is, was it manifestly wrong? And then the other issue is, which Justice Douglas brought up, was her credibility adequately litigated at trial? The first issue is, it wasn't wrong. Those social security numbers and aliases came out of the 2001 PSI, the PSI for her felony convictions. So we didn't have a time frame as to those. Ms. Frenchwood mentioned that she had been a long-term substitute school teacher in her early years, and she was 54 at the time of her testimony. So I would submit early years are probably in her 20s, so that would have been 30 years prior. And Mr. Arnn makes the argument in his briefs that because it was around 10 years ago, and the social security numbers were around 10 years ago, I should have been able to bring it up. Not true. And the way we analyzed it was, if we can't even bring up a felony conviction that's more than 10 years old, how can we bring up evidence that isn't supported in any manner from a PSI that's from those felony convictions from over 10 years ago? The other issue is, it was adequately litigated at trial. We brought up, we didn't present her in good care as a good character. We brought up the fact that she was a crack addict, had been a crack addict at the time of these crimes. In fact, she testified that she had smoked crack just a few days before her testimony. The two felony convictions.
How did that come out?
Ms. Hatcher asked the question. I objected, and Judge Herndon allowed her to ask, when was the last time you used crack? And she stated it was the day before Easter, which had just passed.
Okay.
So that was something that was adequately litigated at trial, and our position is it wasn't manifestly wrong in any manner. The issues that Mr. Arnn just brought up, I'd like to briefly touch upon because they've been mischaracterized, and it's very important to review the record. As for the .45 caliber gun that had Nelson's DNA on it, I'd like to point you to his appendix, volume 12, page 1055. Mr. Arnn argues now tension Tavares, but at the time of trial, he specifically asked that a Tavares instruction not be given because he stated that we hadn't presented as a bad act. So for him to come in now and argue it, and the argument that he makes isn't a correct basis of the facts. The detectives never said that this BB gun was the gun used. And in fact, they disputed that at trial. But that's all an argument that he had available to him at trial as to the relevance of that BB gun or non-relevance of the BB gun. Again, as to Ms. LaShawna Haywood's letter, I would point you to volume 13, page 1355 to 1356, volume 14, page 1411 to 1413. Mr. Arnn did not object to those letters coming in, and in fact, he just asked for a limiting instruction, which was read to the jury on four occasions, once with a reading of each letter and then once during jury instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't move to sever from Ms. Hayward. He only moved to sever from Mr. Scott. He never brought up Duxworth or any of those things prior to those letters being admitted, and he didn't object to them. That's because it was very clear that the he in that letter was Eddie Hecker, And in fact, if you look at the cross-examination of Detective Hanna by Ms. Hatcher, she clarifies with him that the he is Eddie Hecker. So it was in front of the jury that the state's position was that the he was Eddie Hecker. So that's why there was no issue as to Bruton or Duxworth, and that's why Mr. Oram, a talented attorney, didn't raise it prior to trial. As for Joseph Fleming, there was no stipulation. Mr. Oram states now there was stipulation. It absolutely, you'll find it was nowhere in the record. In fact, Mr. Tomczyk, the first thing he says when we come back into court is, Mr. Oram wants to get into this unrelated arrest for murder, and the judge says, how is that coming in? It's absolute quintessential bad act evidence. 48.05 precludes it. And so the ruling, and I point you to volume 14, page 1408 to 1411, the ruling specifically was, you cannot ask anyone whether Joseph Fleming was arrested for an unrelated murder. And that's it. In fact, the ruling contemplated that he'd be able to call witnesses. And in fact, the ruling contemplated that the state might want to bring out the unrelated murder in response to those witnesses, because he might suggest that somehow this Joyce Fleming had said that her son was involved, when in fact she had said, I was sad about the death of Eddie Hecker, and my son is being investigated for a murder. And her co-workers put two and two together and thought, maybe it's the Eddie Hecker murder. That was the status of that evidence. And so Mr. Oram had all the discretion he wanted to call those people as witnesses. He was not prepared from calling witnesses. I'd like to address Alonzo Ward's as well. We dispute the version of the facts in that as Mr. Oram presents them. Here's what the record bears out. There was one photographic lineup containing Mr. Nelson. Only one. And it was shown to Mr. Nelson, Mr. Woods, in CCDC on November 21st, 2008, 2 months after the crimes, when Alonzo Woods was in custody on a probation violation. Our brief has a typo in it when it says, and Mr. Oram kind of poked fun at me, I think, during his argument, there's a typo in it. It says that there were three photographic lineups containing Nelson. There were actually three photographic lineups containing people with the nickname General. But only one of those was Mr. Nelson. So there was only one photographic lineup ever prepared with Mr. Nelson's photograph in it. Then there was...
That was a six-photo.
It was a six-photograph, six-pack.
Okay.
Then Mr. Nelson and Mr. Woods, a few days later, are walked past each other at CCDC. This wasn't... It was a surprise, Alonzo Woods said to him. It was a surprise. He didn't know that it was going to happen. And on cross-examination, he told Mr. Nelson, and even Mr. Oram, I recognized him at that time. I knew, and he looked the same as he had during the incident, but because of my own reasons, I didn't say anything. And he tried to say his reasons, and Mr. Oram cuts him off, but later he's able to talk about those reasons, which we've outlined. There's a grand jury presentation in June of 2009. Mr. Woods has never shown any photograph of Mr. Nelson or a six-pack at that proceeding. Then he testifies that Alzora Jackson, in preparation for the trial in 2011, because she represented John Scott, had gone up and spoke to him at prison, because he was revoked in 2009 with a release date of May of 2012. So he was still in prison this entire time. And he testified that she showed him that same photographic lineup that he had seen with Detective Hanna. And then he testified that 4 or 5 days prior to trial, his testimony, that we had met with him during a pretrial conference, and that he again had looked at that photographic lineup. And he testified that he told us and he told Ms. Jackson that he was going to identify Charles Nelson in court. He did not tell us that he was going to identify Charles Nelson in court, and we did not show him the photographic lineup. And that we made a record of. After the pretrial conference, when we were in court on April 25th, and then again on April 26th, before he testified, Mr. Oram brought up the fact that Alzora Jackson had told him that Mr. Nelson and Mr. Ruth had told her that he was going to identify Nelson at trial. And that was the first we heard of it. And that's when Mr. Tomczyk said, we have no idea whether he's going to identify Mr. Nelson. From our understanding, he's never identified him from a photographic lineup. In fact, if we would have shown him a photographic lineup and we would have picked him out, that would be something that we would want to memorialize in a new trial. Because it would have eviscerated Mr. Oram's later claim that he was pointing to the only person at the defense table. So certainly, we would have brought that up. There was no testimony ever that anybody showed him a single photograph or that anybody picked Nelson's photograph out and pointed it out. In fact, the entire time when he's talking about these photographs of Nelson, if you go back in the testimony, he's referring to State's Exhibit 20, which was the photographic lineup. And that's all mostly done on cross-examination by Mr. Orem. So truly, this is a case that's more like Browning v. State out of this court from 1988, in which Josie Elson, the victim's wife, couldn't identify from a photographic lineup, and then came into court and identified. And that was a case in which this court analyzed it as, we're not really in the bigger Stovall-Simmons test, because this is a case in which she's doing it in front of court with cross-examination right there. And so really, we don't even have to get to the analysis, but let's suggest that possibly he did recognize him, he had identified him, because he testified that he did recognize him when he saw him in November of 2008, and that he in his mind knew that was the guy who did it, but he didn't say it for his own reasons. Then the analysis is this really unnecessarily suggestive? And number two, if so, was it still reliable? I would suggest to you that this is not like Foster at all. This is a single photographic lineup, which he may have seen more than once, and then a walkthrough, not a one-on-one. So it's more like Thompson v. State, wherein the victim looks at a photographic lineup and says she's 90% certain that's him, and then comes into court and IDs. And I would also submit to you that even if this were unnecessarily suggestive, there is a plethora of evidence showing that this was extremely reliable in court identification. Not only did he testify on cross-examination when Mr. Orem tried to get him to say that he was only recognizing him from the photographs, that no, you don't forget things like a gun being pointed in your face. I got a good look at him. I remember him. But also, in court, he wasn't asked a question. He literally was asked a question like, what happened next? And he said, when that dude right there came from behind the door and pointed a gun in my face. And Judge Herndon analyzes it as well, saying that Alonzo Woods' reasoning for not having said anything at the beginning, and later, after being in prison for some time, changing his mind and deciding, despite the fact that he's a long-term criminal, it's against everything he stands for to snitch, and now he's not going to have a chance to handle it the way he wanted to handle it, like he handled the murder that he committed. He came into court later and identified. And Judge Herndon specifically said he understood why every juror believed that. So we have a case in which it's an extremely reliable input identification, and the jury got to see the credibility of Mr. Woods as he looked at Mr. Nelson and pointed to him. Thank you.
Okay, just let me just see if there are any questions from the court. As you can see, Justice Sata is participating in these oral arguments from Carson City, and I'm sorry I didn't announce that at the beginning. So, Justice Sata, do you have any questions from Ms. Christensen?
I do not.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Orem.
Cite to the record now so that there is no argument that I am taking things out of context. Page 13 of Respondent's Answer and Brief at lines 20 and 21, they state, here, Detective Hanna showed Woods a photographic lineup including Nelson's picture on three different occasions. Then they say, period. They've referred to 13AA, 1332 through 1335. I then jumped on that because I could not recall how many times Mr. Detective Hanna had showed that. That is their admission, not mine. With regard to some of these other statements, I would like to read some of Mr. Woods' trial testimony. Question to Mr. Woods. Did you tell these prosecutors you were going to come into court and identify Mr. Nelson, Christopher Nelson, because he kept using the name incorrectly? He answers, I already knew who Nelson was from the photos seen numerous times, so yes. Question. So you told the prosecutors you were going to identify him in court? Answer, yes. After the court inquired of Mr. Woods as to whether anyone else had shown pictures, the question was, which prosecutors? Josh and Mel. Question, showed you photographs of Mr. Nelson? Yes, sir. Mr. Woods was then asked, did you tell the prosecutors you recognized him? Yeah, why wouldn't I? It's constantly stored in my face. So I also would dispute something else that the state says.
Does that clarify then from your standpoint? When that admission was made that he was going to testify, because that seems to be the right now the dispute as a timing.
I cannot tell. He says he just says that he told the prosecutor she was going to identify him. And so I can't tell because obviously I'm not there. I was just, having heard it, it was obviously something that I was surprised about because Mr. Tomczyk had told the court on two occasions, I don't know whether he's going to identify him. You see, from my point of view, I'm listening to a prosecutor telling the court, I don't know if he's going to identify him. But then the witness gets up and says, I told him I was going to identify him. I hope I don't have to pick those out of context to see why that would be somewhat disturbing in a capital murder trial. But you're wondering, who is being candid here? And interestingly enough, the state in their answering brief said, here, there was no pretrial identification as there was in all the cases cited by Nelson in his opening brief. So I read that and I'm thinking to myself, I'm not reading my opening brief. I'm citing to it and just, like you asked, Justice Douglas, when was that identification? But I'm citing to the record, surely they're not saying he didn't say that. And so I like an explanation as to why as well. I don't like it when the state just turns around and says, there was no pretrial identification. It's not true, or at least that's not what Alonzo Woods is saying. And you know, that's really not the point. The point is, this is so suggestive. This lineup was so suggestive because it was over and over and over. And Alonzo Woods said it best. He said, hey, it was always shoved in my face. And for the state to argue, I like this clever argument, that the reason he doesn't identify first is because he's sort of a hardened criminal who's going to take care of it himself. Three real problems with that. One, if that's true, why in the first time does he see John Scott in a photographic lineup and say, there's the man who attacked me? So he immediately identifies John Scott, and now he's facing his only capital murder trial. Two, when he walked by him at the Clark County Detention Center, why didn't he attack him? Because if he's going to take care of it, no better place to take care of it than in the jail. According to the detectives, he looked like he didn't remember who the man was. Okay? And third, if he's such a tough guy who's never going to ID because he's going to take care of it his own street level kind of way, then why does he come into court and identify him? That's the problem. And when you look at all of those in the totality of circumstances, given the limited nature of evidence against Mr. Nelson, no scientific evidence putting him at that scene. In fact, Ms. Frenchwood said that Mr. Nelson, right before he went in to commit the crime, asked for socks. Really strange thing, because you think maybe that's gloves. Put on socks, went in and committed the crime. They found socks at the scene. So they DNA tested it. And what did they find? Not Mr. Nelson's DNA, but the co-defendant, Mr. Scott. Why is that even more important? Because Ms. Frenchwood, that real credible school teacher, said Mr. Scott wasn't present with her that day. And we know that Mr. Scott was. We know Mr. Scott's guilty. It's obvious. The state agrees with that because they're going to charge him, or they've charged him, and they're going to try to sentence him to death. So I don't know how they try to reconcile the fact that Ms. Frenchwood wouldn't even say Mr. Scott was there. I'd ask for a reversal. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, you said I only comment reference to the letter that you spoke on and the fact that you didn't object to its admission as...
Ms. Christensen is correct. There wasn't an objection. She's correct. I, at the time of trial, I asked for a limiting instruction, but I did not know prior to trial that they would put in that section, that there were letters. It wasn't as though I would know that they would try to do something that would, in essence, make it so that error occurred. Once the letter, they said they were going to put in the letter, I asked for cautionary instruction. Should I have done the same thing I did here? I would suggest so. But I was... I had no idea prior to trial that they would put that piece of evidence in.
And in your rebuttal as to the statement as to Mr. Fleming, you indicated there was some type of stipulation.
Yes, I sent you over a brief, and I noticed Ms. Christensen said that. If I could... Okay, here's what is said on the record. I say this on the record. I discussed... This is on page 13 of my reply brief, found at volume 14, pages 14 and 9. I discussed with Mr. Tomczyk on Friday. He had indicated that he had no difficulty with me talking, or he said he had no difficulty with the murder coming into evidence. He introduced the scope, so I thought he was going to ask about it, because he introduced Mr. Fleming's scope. What I see from this is that Mr. Fleming, and then it's .. And so, to me, if that is not a stipulation, if that wasn't an agreement, why did Mr. Tomczyk say, that's not the agreement, Judge? Mr. Warren, I don't know where he's coming up with it, but I'm actually saying it 5 years before. He just remained silent. And I didn't get a chance to do it, but I hope the court would also look at the comments about prosecutorial statements that are made by Mr. Tomczyk in the closing rebuttal argument. And if there are no further questions.
We certainly look at all issues. You know, we appreciate both of your excellent arguments and briefs.